Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You may call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to our live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on unsolved or specific, I cannot talk. Suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
And tonight our first case is going to be out of Merced County, California. It's the case from May 21, 2001 of the murder in Merced of 29-year-old Leonard Martinez. At around 10 p.m. that night, Leonard Martinez was in his home on Stretch Road watching television while his fiancée cooked a late dinner. When he responded to a knock on the door, he was shot several times and died on the doorstep. Joining us tonight to discuss this unsolved homicide is Sheriff Mark Pazin of Merced County. Sheriff Pazin is a third-generation Mercedian. His interest in public safety began in the 1970s when he started work as an EMT-1, and simultaneously was sworn in as a reserve deputy sheriff for Merced County. He became a full-time deputy sheriff in 1981. In 2002, he was elected to the office of sheriff coroner and assumed his duty shortly thereafter. Sheriff Pazin was reelected in the 2000 and 2010 elections. He holds an Associate of Arts degree from Merced Community College and a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of San Francisco and is a graduate of the FBI National Academy. Sheriff Pazin, welcome to CrimeWire.
Well, Danny, thanks for having me. This is a real treat for us over here in California. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're glad you're on board. And when I was talking to Tom McKenzie in your public information office, I indicated to him that, you know, if you have cases that you'd like to get profiled, then we're certainly happy to help in any way we can. And if we can, talk to the you or the investigators and perhaps the family members, we'd certainly love to help you out.
Well, you know, and this gets into the very crux of how we really solve cases. You know, we can go through the laborious aspects of investigations, collect evidence, but as you well know, Danny, that there's always a missing piece of the puzzle, and that's somebody coming forward with that very important part that will help us solve the case. Because, as you well know, it's not always putting the facts of the case together, and I say that in a holistic view, but it's also making sure that we have the entire process done correctly for prosecution, because we're just one part of the judicial system as far as the investigation goes. We have the prosecution, and obviously we have the judicial process wherein we have the jury. So it sounds complicated, but at its very basic elements, it's not. And we just want to do our part, and I appreciate you having us on the show.
Well, Sheriff, before we get into talking about the Leonard Martinez case, would you tell us and the listeners a little bit about Merced County, the size, the population, that type of thing?
Well, Merced County is unique that we truly are in the – we're in the Central Valley and at the heart of the San Joaquin Valley. If you look at California from 30,000 feet, you'll see Merced is has major thoroughfares of Interstate 5, Highway 99, Highway 152, and Highway 33. I kind of call it the Bermuda Triangle on the west side of our county where, for those persons that are listening, Los Banos, goes over to Pecos Pass, that gets you into the Bay Area. So we have a stable community. It's basically based on agriculture. We do have the University of California at Merced that just opened up a couple years ago, so we're trying to go high-tech on that. We have a base population of approximately 300,000 persons and about 2,200 square miles of our county. We sit approximately 2 hours due south of Sacramento, and then we're about 5 hours north of Los Angeles, that major hub. So we truly sit right in the middle and at the heart of California.
And Sheriff, what size is your department? Is it the large, a medium?
I would consider us a medium-sized department, Denny. We have collateral duties. I am not only the elected sheriff for Merced, but also carry on the duties as the administrative coroner here in Merced. We also have court security. We have, obviously, operations that we take care of, you know, patrol services. We have a major crime unit. We have a gang task force. We have all the little things that you see on television. And we also have a correctional division, and we have approximately 700 to 800 inmates here. And those inmates, they're not like the Otis of Mayberry. These are thugs. They're hooligans. They're killers. They're sexual deviants that we have because of the overcrowding that every agency has. We sometimes have to release the best of the worst. And also we have a communications division and of the coroner's offices I also mentioned.
Well, thank you, Sheriff. Could you then get in for us a little bit to the details of what happened to Mr. Martinez on the night of that May night in 2001?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate this. You know, basically, from our what we have gleaned from the investigation dating back to 2001. It was May, you know, over here in California, just like in Las Vegas, it's daylight savings time. There was a knock on the door. Mr. Martinez and his fiancée were in the process of cooking dinner. Denise, his then fiancée, was just, you know, doing her thing in the kitchen. Knock at the door, doorbell rings, and next thing you know, shots are heard by the fiance. She waits. Obviously, she's paralyzed with fear and stays in the kitchen until there's some quiet time, goes out and finds the decedent, Leonard Martinez, lying face down on the carpet just inside the doorway of the residence that, you know, obviously broaches the front porch. Multiple gunshot wounds. She immediately calls 911. Our deputies arrive, try to administer first aid, but unfortunately he expired right there. What makes this case interesting is that we believe, obviously, that Mr. Martinez knew his assailant. We don't think it was an arbitrary type of killing, that there was a plan, scheme, and design to this, because our investigators had found that Mr. Martinez had been in the backyard earlier, had heard the door being knocked on or the doorbell being rang. By the time he got to the front door, he saw someone walking down the street, didn't pay any attention to it, went back to his business. whereupon his fiance came home and they started cooking dinner.
No leads or anything, no, you know, tips, no, you know, because there was nothing on this case on the internet, on a Facebook page, on a site for this person. A lot of times what we do is we ask the people, the cases that we put on, that they do a page so that there might be an interest whereby it's only, it's also on your page at your office, at the sheriff's office, but it's also out there on the internet so people can also see it and it crawls through the web.
Yeah, and for, you know, here's what happens here. It's just not just this case, but historically, people are really skittish about coming forward. And that's why we enjoy these programs. That's why we love Jackie McDonald here in Merced, because she keeps not only the Martinez case, but all of them on the forefront. People, you know, it's always perplexing that someone won't have an anonymous tip. We have so many websites, and as you had mentioned, Facebook, tip lines and such. We have Merced County's Most Wanted, that we have a website up and running that people can go ahead and put in anonymous information.
But don't you think, I'm not trying to be interruptive, don't you think,
okay,
though, that what happens is they're not going to go to your site because they feel that it's somehow going to be, you know, trapped through the IP, or so they might be more likely to go to a family site as a suggestion. Is that maybe a way,
you know,
of thinking from people?
That's a true story. That's a true story. But we're trying to educate the community that we're really not. Why would we go ahead and kill the goose that would lay the golden egg for us, is what I'm saying.
But they don't know
so
that.
Well, but that's why these shows are so very important. And that's why here in Merced County, we try and go ahead and go out to the media and say, we're not going to trace these calls. You know, we even have the anonymous tip lines. And the same thing, if you're talking about the IP address, you could theoretically go back and find that also. What we're trying to do is educate the community and say, we're not into that. We want to catch the killer. We need to have some closure for the Martinez family, or fill in the blank of any family that's been subjected to a horrifying murder.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Sheriff, Vito.
Yeah.
Sheriff, you mentioned that the theory, I guess, is that Mr. Martinez probably was acquainted or knew his assailant or assailants. Do you any other information along those lines? Like, had he been having trouble with anyone, fights with neighbors or coworkers, any of that kind of stuff?
Well, good question. That's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked. Through the course of doing interviews, we did talk to the fiance, and she did say that Leonard did have a problem with a, quote, a former friend. This former friend, which is going to be an oxymoron after I tell you that this friend sold him a stolen car. So they got into some verbal arguments prior or leading up to Mr. Martinez being shot and killed in cold blood at his house. Now, we ran down those leads regarding the, quote, friend that did this, and at this point in time, he, quote, had an alibi. So, you know, it gets back to the very essence of why we have this radio show, and again, I want to thank you, is that we need to keep these things on the forefront. I know deep in my heart that there are people that will listen to this. And in Las Vegas is such a transient area that somebody could be listening right now and say, you know what, I'm from that Central Valley area. I know what's going on, and I need to call.
Go ahead, Vito.
And, Sheriff, before we get too much farther along, do you want to provide any lines or anything, phone lines or websites that you recommend anyone with information go to or call to?
You know, if people are nervous, Danny, they can call, write a letter. Here's our address. And you can just write, pen a letter. I know it's snail mail, but it'll get to us. It's Merced County Sheriff's Office, 700 West 22nd, Merced, California, 95340. We have tip lines. We have MercedCountysMostWanted.com. Again, that's MercedCountysMostWanted.com, that they can go ahead and put in any information that they wish. Our dispatch service is 209-385-7000. 7444. And our people are trained when something like this occurs and someone wants to go ahead and help by giving us information to put a killer behind bars, that they just get the basics of who they think did it, give us the leads, and we can take it from there. And that's what's so very important.
Vito?
Sheriff, excuse me, before I pass the baton here, do your personnel believe that this is a solvable case? Do they think this, I guess every case can be solved, but do they consider this case a high probability that it could be solved?
You know, I'm going to take what you just said. Every case is solvable if other persons get involved. You know, I've been doing this for 30-plus years, and people like to brag. They like to talk. Somebody put someone up to doing that. There's no secrets in the underworld, and it always really perplexes me that the persons that do this are gutless. This horrific crime, I think, showcases just how I don't know, I don't want to get too brazen on the radio, but I'm going to take the liberty of doing such, if that's okay. You know, you got these pack of dingoes that are traipsing around Nevada, California, wherever, that feel that they can get away with these crimes. And somebody has to step up to the plate, take a swing at the ball, and help out their local law enforcement. I don't care if it's Las Vegas Metro, Merced County Sheriff's Office, LASO, whatever the case is. These are, back to your question, Denny, they're all solvable if people would get involved. And I'm not saying to the point of where you're going to testify and have to go through the rigors of court, but we have enough evidence here. We have enough items collected to link the killer to the crime if somebody would just help. That's all we're asking.
So you do have some evidence then, and if the right person comes forward, this could be a closed case perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah, we know that the report speaks for itself. We're looking for a small caliber weapon. I don't want to compromise the case by telling exactly what it is, but there were a number of shell casings that we collected, so should we at some point in time find the gun, we'll be able to match the indentation on the shell casing with the weapon used. So what I'm saying is we also got some other forensics that I won't get into right now, but we just need to be pointed in the right direction. And I think the Martinez
Sheriff,
family.
In addition to the selling, this alleged or so-called former friend selling Mr. Martinez a stolen vehicle, are there other theories also out there or possibilities? Anything looks real strong?
Well, you know, we kind of got focused in on the friend because he did sell him a stolen car. Mr. Martinez got labeled with a snitch jacket a couple weeks prior to because he had gone forward and told his friends not to call him back, that this other fella got in trouble from the Merced Police Department with the stolen car. And it never really ceases to amaze me what draconian measures someone will take, you know, to eliminate somebody. And this may be the case here of what had occurred. So, but a good law enforcement technique is not to get so focused on one element that we also have a couple other theories of a neighbor dispute. It could have been another gang, kind of a gang involvement. It could have been a case of mistaken identity. All those things are plausible for us, and we're not dismissing those.
You mentioned, you know, that one of the other possibilities is gang involvement. Is there quite a bit of gang activity in the county there or in the city of Merced?
You know, these these jackals have infiltrated Merced County. They're going into third and fourth generation. It's been a mess over here, and unfortunately, we're not a unique population here in Merced County. You do have these donkeys who believe in this gang lifestyle that are meandering the streets. We had a number of shootings in the calendar year 2010. They believe in this lifestyle. So, yeah, we're not, our county's not unique to these folks, these gangsters floating around here, that's for sure.
Vito.
And that problem, the gang problem and the infiltration of these gangs, what's your sense in that? Do you think it's like stable? You think it's getting worse? Or what's your opinion on the gang situation?
Well, my opinion is this. I'm going to use this quick analogy, is that, you know, you have a family that has a business. They pass that business on, whether it's the fuel industry, whether you own a store, whether you're a school teacher, or the case is, you try and invoke that type of learning and education onto that, to your offspring, to the next generation. Unfortunately, we have the antithesis of this via the gang lifestyle, because you have families teaching their offspring how to be gangsters. And until we break that cycle, one generation is going to beget the next generation and so on down the line, until some of them are either going to be killed or incarcerated, or they'll continue to procreate their next generation. I think quite humbly that... Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, Sheriff, if this too, like we're talking about, if people are willing to step up to the plate, you know, and help out, help their local law enforcement, it would not only be necessarily, you know, in a case where it's gotten to the homicide case, but if people see illegal activity, be it selling drugs, be it, you know, larceny, whatever it happens to be, they can report that too, right? I mean, they don't have to wait till somebody dies to let the law enforcement, the people know that there's something going on, or maybe some bad people out there.
Yeah, Danny, you would think so. I mean, for heaven's sakes, the quality of life stems from persons getting involved. And you can go ahead and I don't want people to take this wrong, but you can join service clubs, and that's fine, and fraternal organizations, that's great. Donate during the Christmas holidays, okay. But to really have a firm foundation on a quality of life, I believe that people have to be involved on a day-to-day basis. When they see criminal activity, they need to report it. We just had an incident last week in Merced County where a good neighbor called in anonymously 911, who saw people congregating, a male and female, did the typical daytime burglary, knocked on the front door, nobody answers, male goes around the back, female has the car running in the at the front yard. And fortunately, a neighbor saw it, calls it in. We had deputies respond and caught these two thugs, and they're in jail right now. The point of that comment was this. If you hear something, you need to report it. If you see something, you need to report it. Because, like you say, this transcends across just a homicide. It transcends if you think there's a house that's selling drugs, if you know where a marijuana garden is, the whole litany of criminal activity.
Vito?
Yes, Sheriff. A couple
yes.
of questions for you. Did Mr. Martinez have a criminal history, number one, and number two, from his history, did he have any involvement in drugs that you knew of?
You know what? I don't have the... those are two excellent questions, and I know he was gainfully employed. He had gone to pick up his fiancée from her place of employment, and I we'll have to look up here. I'm at my computer right now. I can look that up. That's a great question. But the report doesn't indicate him having any previous law enforcement interaction on the negative side.
So now the fiance was what, in the kitchen at the stove cooking the dinner. By the time she got to Leonard, did she hear any car leave the area, or did she see anybody, or did she just tend to Leonard and didn't look?
I think she subconsciously just blew everything out. She heard the door, doorbell or the door knock. Next thing you know, shots are fired. She went into a catatonic state, shut down, and didn't hear anything after that. But she, what she did was heard Leonard scream, you know, because of being shot. And that was about it to the extent of what she heard or was able to help us out with the exception of the friend being upset because Leonard had gone forward and went ahead and told local law enforcement about the stolen vehicle.
Okay, okay. And I think it was a very good point you made near the beginning of the show, Sheriff, especially me being a former police officer myself. You mentioned about putting the case together for the prosecution. And a lot of times on prim shows like we have and on TV and everything else, the public doesn't understand that you need to have very solid evidence if you're going to make these cases stick. And can you explain that a little bit to the audience? Because I hear it so much, like, why don't they just arrest this guy? They know it's this one or they know it's that one. And sometimes the public don't realize how much work is involved in the you know, getting the arrest warrant signed.
Yeah, you know, and back to your previous question, Leonard did have a little some interaction with law enforcement, some assaults and batteries, some trespassing, but it looks like that they had it pled out of court. So he had some misdemeanors in his background, but nothing that would warrant his killing, that's for darn sure. Back
okay.
to your second question, sir, is that,
yeah.
You know, it's true. You know, I think people are so used to the television way of how a crime is committed and how a crime is adjudicated and how a crime is punished. And I wish I was Mark Harmon on NCIS, where I could go ahead and start at 8 p.m. and I love the show and I like the guy and have it finished at 9 p.m. plus commercials and everything falls into place and that cold, steely look will have everybody just babbling like a brook and going ahead and acknowledging what they had done wrong and confessing. It doesn't happen like that in the real world. These are very labor-intensive investigations. T's have to be crossed, I's have to be dotted, because the court is an adversarial system. You have the prosecution and you have the defense. And they have to convince a jury of 12 beyond a shadow of a doubt. Did it.
I think the sheriff just got muted. There we go.
You what?
You there, Sheriff? You got
I'm
a little,
here.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's a good point. And not only that, I think probably all the female listeners wish you were Mark Harmon, but that's another story.
Well, you know what? I don't want to go. They say I look like him. Does that help?
No, well, don't ask me. Ask the women listeners. Does that help, Susan?
No comento. We are out of time. Please give the number again, sir, for people to provide tips.
Yeah, we certainly would appreciate anything. Area code 209-385-7444, or you can go to MercedCountySheriff.com. Again, www.MercedCountySheriff.com. It has our full website, and we appreciate any help on anything. And I tell you what, if I can go a step further, if you feel antsy about calling your local jurisdiction, wherever you're listening from, we will make sure that whatever intelligence we gather will get to the right jurisdiction. If you feel that we're going to try and trap you and to testify, we're not going to do that. We just need the help.
Thank you, sir, and we'll have you back again very soon.
Very good. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Herb.
Thank you.
All right, Vito.
Okay, here we go. All right, I have a privilege tonight to introduce my buddy on this, who's on our show now.
No, it's not a buddy. She is treated like everybody else here. Now, come on. She's a crime lawyer consultant.
I knew her longer than you. Huh? Anyway, she is one of the premier attorneys in the entire country, and I'm going to give her a little background of her here. Ann Bremner is a former prosecutor. She's now in private practice, has been involved in several high-profile cases during her career. You may also know her as an expert legal analyst on CNN, Headline News. I even think the other night I saw her on the Food Channel on a throwdown with Bobby Flay. But anyway, she is right now, I think her main job is she is Charlie Sheen's PR agent. I don't think that's
going to be.
But anyway, Ann Bremner is representing the parents of missing mother Susan Cox Powell of Utah, Chuck and Judy Cox, as they continue their search for their missing daughter as well as justice in her name. And let's use the Susan Powell case as an example. The woman has been missing since December 6, 2009. She vanished from her home in Utah, and the person of interest is her husband, Josh Powell. They have not located her remains, and there is no arrest in this case. You are representing the family in a possible wrongful death case. Ann, how important is it for families to seek representation in these types of cases?
Well, I think it's crucial, but I want to thank you first for the intro. And if I was Charlie Sheen's lawyer, I'd be saying, you know, winning, duh, not.
Yeah,
but.
And you know what? Let's just back up. Who writes your intro, Denny? You know, na-na-na-na-na. Women rock.
Well, you're not the attorney. You're his PR agent, Ann.
Yeah, exactly, right. Lucky me. Huh? I think that's a whole other story. But in the Susan Cox Powell case, I think it's so important for the family to seek help because, first, they need help with dealing with the criminal prosecution and what it means and why it's slow and why they need evidence and, you know, what they're looking for. But I also think, as we all know, in a wrongful death case, civil, the standard of proof is so much lower than criminal. And we saw in the OJ case, of course, he was acquitted in the criminal case, but of course convicted, so to speak, in the civil case. And you always want to look at, should we look at a civil case to get justice if the prosecution is not going to happen, or what can we do to help the prosecution in what they have or what they don't have? And this case is just tragic, but the good thing is that Josh Powell keeps mouthing off, so to speak, like Charlie Sheen, and saying all kinds of things like that she would be chewed up like hamburger when she came home, that she was promiscuous, that she had this other life, all these falsities that will only help the prosecution if and when they file a case.
Can I ask you real quick? Go ahead, sorry.
Do you think this is a solvable case, Ann?
I do. I think anyone that would believe that he would camping with his children in the middle of the night in sub-zero temperatures and then just happened to find that his wife was missing when there was like a stain on the floor and there was marital discord where she had a diary about wanting to leave him, that this is not a homicide, I think is delusional. I mean, this is a guy that wanted to control his wife. She couldn't have credit cards. She couldn't do anything. She was a breadwinner. And when she sought to leave him, he became unglued. And he gave this story that he was out in the middle of the night camping with these kids. And I think the key is the kids and what they say about mom being in the cave, different things about what happened that night and over those period of days, that it just, you know, it's just phenomenally incredible that story could be true. And then when you start from there and you go on to where she would never leave her children, she loved them very, very much and would do anything to be with them, and there's no trace of her, no credit cards, no spending money, no moving somewhere, no boyfriend. He said she ran off with a missing man from Utah. I mean, he's just said so many things that could help the prosecution's case that we're hoping that the authorities go forward and charge him.
In this kind of a... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Susan.
I was going to ask about someone like a Vito. You know, do they come to you first because for a wrongful death case, or they don't like the way the police are going in the investigation? I know it's kind of not their say. Does somebody like a private eye like Vito an investigation before they come to you, or you know, to get more answers? Does that help in a wrongful death case too, while they're looking for her?
We could use Vito big time on this case. Yeah, I mean, they come to someone like me when they're frustrated with the case that it's not going anywhere, or they don't know where it's going, so they say, what else can we do? And the question is, would we go for a wrongful death case, or would that hurt the prosecution? And right now we're waiting to see what the authorities do before we take any steps, because we want to make sure that justice is done, and the best justice is a prosecution.
So to the public, though, do they come to you first, or do they go to and sit and wait? And do they have a timeline?
Well, what they did in this case is they've always, you know, cooperated with the authorities, but after time went on and on and on and there was nothing happening, then they come to someone like me and say, you know what, are we doing everything we can do? Because, of course, the family wants to make sure they've left no stone unturned, and that's where they are. And they've also been all over the airwaves in terms of the case and, you know, any kind of clues that the public can give. And I think that's so laudable because it's so hard to go on the air and talk about their daughter when they're going through the grief process, knowing that she's probably not coming back. Although they do say they think she could be coming back, which, you know, I guess hope springs eternal, but it's been a very long time.
Ann, can I ask you a question? This is Benny. In the case, I was doing a little research online about wrongful death, several suits, and you mentioned the O.J. Simpson case, and of course that sticks in my mind about using a civil action to find him, what was it, liable or whatever the term is. But I saw some very short, what I thought, statute of limitations, and it varies by state, of course, but some were 1 year. I mean, you take a family that's in the shock of having a loved one murdered, and they might not even be thinking rationally, and, you know, you tend to trust the police. I mean, you got to believe that the system's going to work for you, and
right.
That year, if it takes over that year or 2 years or whatever it is for the family to say, wait a minute, this thing isn't moving, it's stalled, or there's no suspects, or no whatever it is, and they have a person, the family has someone they believe did it. It might be too late. In other words, if the statute runs, then where are you? If you're in a place with a 1 year statute or 2 years, is that the end of the road?
Well, it is, and that's what your listeners really need to know in terms of their loved ones. It can be 1 year, it can be 2 years on an intentional tort, it could be 3 years on negligence, but pretty consistently across the country, we have pretty short statutes on wrongful death, as opposed to the criminal statute, which is life. It doesn't matter. You can file any time on a homicide. And I think we need to change the laws, just like we have in sexual assault, where we've allowed people to say, you know what, I only discovered how it affected me at such and such a time or date, and then the statute runs from there. I think wrongful death needs the same kind of extension of the statute of limitations in civil cases, because the Powell case is a great example. You know, we don't know what happened. The authorities are taking a lot of time, and the family trusts them. On the other hand, they may be then barred by a statute of limitations from filing their own case to see justice. So I think we need to see a change in the statutes because they're short. They're really short.
Hey, Ann,
is there something a family can do if they think that they may want to go with a civil suit, but aren't sure yet or something? Is there anything they can do, file a notice of claim? Is there something they could do to preserve their time and told the statute to stop it from running? Or is there no action they can take? It's either got to go whole way or no way.
It's, you know, it's kind of the whole way or no way. Unless they're going to go against a government entity, then you file a notice of claim and then you've got some more time. But against an individual, you really don't. And so you don't have any kind of claim for an extension unless it's against the city or the county in a given state with a claim that gives you a little bit more time. And I think that, you know, we all think, well, you can, like, on wrongful death, it should be, like, for life, you know, in terms of the criminal case, in terms of how long you can wait. But we just haven't caught up in the civil statutes, and I don't think we contemplate civil cases in wrongful death cases in many respects. O.J. Simpson is a great example, but it's kind of one that's pretty finite. You don't see it that often that you see a civil case in a wrongful death.
Now, let me just ask you about Simpson. It was quite a while before he was acquitted, you know, after the homicide. And I'm just wondering about the statute of limitations there. I think California had a one-year statute, so that did they have to then file a civil wrongful death before the criminal trial had ended? So that would have been, like, ongoing at the same time or on the record at the same time?
Yes, and that's a problem for the prosecution because there can also be cross-examination against the family saying, well, you filed a civil case. You want money. You have a financial interest and bias. But that really wasn't brought out in this criminal case. But you remember Daniel, it was at Petrocelli that represented the victims in the case, and also John Q. Kelly did a phenomenal job in the civil case. And some arguments are that the reason that happened is because when you have private lawyers and private money, you have a better result than when you have the prosecution involved in putting together a case, which is sad, you know, that he was acquitted with a public prosecution. Vito?
I'm just curious about let's suppose the family of the victim is getting the sense that things aren't going as they would like in the investigation. And they say, well, maybe we ought to go ahead and within the statute of limitations for the civil action, file something. What kind of a fee or what are they going to have to come up with, you know, any guesstimate on what they'd have to come up with financially if they wanted to do that, to protect their, you know, to preserve the thing and not let the statute run? Is it the cost prohibitive? I mean, you got to be a millionaire to do this?
Well, I think that most lawyers that get involved in these cases, like me, do it pro bono or on a contingency so that there's nothing that they have to put forward up front. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a pretty thriving practice, and when people come to me in cases like this, I volunteer my services to try and help them get resolution in their case. I'm not looking for money. I'm looking for justice, and that's what they're looking for. In the O.J. Simpson case, I forgot what the verdict was. It's pretty high. Of course, they couldn't collect all of it, but that one I'm sure was a contingency, so there's nothing up front from the victims that they have to pay.
Yeah, that was like $55 million. It was tremendous.
Yeah, I know. And I think that there was such cheering across the United States when that verdict came in because it was like, well, now that's justice, you know. We didn't see it in the criminal case. And, you know, that's what we see in a lot of these cases on a civil burden of proof. It's pretty low, just more likely than not, just 51% as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt, which is very high. And that's why O.J. Simpson paid civilly, and he'll pay for the rest of his life. And, of course, karma dictated that he's in jail now in Las Vegas for other crimes.
And,
Mr. Vito.
If I'm correct, and because this is not, there's no criminal penalty involved in this. If you are found liable or found responsible for the death, it's a civil monitor as far as the judgment goes. So these people pretty much can't weasel out with the Fifth Amendment, right? I mean, they're not incriminating themselves in a criminal case where their liberty might be at stake.
Now, that's a great question. But that's a great question because let's look now at the Powell case. Because there's criminal proceedings underway, we don't know where they are, but we know there's an investigation, then he can take the Fifth Amendment in a deposition. But it can be used against him. But the fact is he can still stymie us in any kind of a civil case that we have because he's got those protections. and those protections remain, you know, in any kind of a criminal case and appeal. And he's almost thumbing his nose at all of it, like that he can say whatever he wants to the press, to his neighbors, at memorial services, et cetera, and do that with impunity right now.
Vito, jump in.
Ann, in regards to the husband, Josh Powell, tell our listeners across the country, what does his day consist of? Is he working? Also tell the listeners, like, the ages of the children so they know, the people out there that don't know too much about the case. Is this guy actively employed? Where is he living now?
Well, he's living in Puyallup, Washington, and what's really important to the case is that as soon as she went missing, he decided to move out of the state of Utah and to live in Washington State in Puyallup. So obviously he didn't think she was coming back. The children have been interviewed from the beginning. They're young. Now, I think right now they're like 4 and 6. And they basically said that their mom was somewhere in a cave, but they've been pretty vague about what happened. And they're going to be re-interviewed by a specialist from the criminal prosecution side. He has basically said that he objects to anybody looking for her, posting banners in the neighborhood, having any kind of vigils for her. And then he came out with the Salt Lake newspaper saying that she was somebody that had boyfriends and ran off willingly and was somebody that was irresponsible, and that her family basically scared her to where she didn't want to come back home because they would basically, as he said, chew her up like hamburger, when in fact they love her. And he's basically put on the family that she was abused by them and she was embarrassed to come back home and see them, and that's why she went missing with some other man.
And the children are with Josh Powell all the time now?
Yes, and the grandparents, Chuck and Judy, have tried to reason with him to see the children. He won't let them see them at all. And they've contemplated legal action, but they don't want to do anything to disrupt the children's lives. So they've tried to work with him, but he won't let them see them at all. And I think that's because they'll say things that, of course, the grandparents will use in the prosecution. So it's amazing to me that he's gone through all of this in a way that he's...
It's incredible. I'm listening to you here, and we've done so many of these cases on TV that it just boggles my mind, okay? As soon as she's missing, he goes, all right, come on, kids, we're out of here. I mean, what's with these guys' heads? I don't understand it. They have no contact with the grandparents, who the children love. That's for exactly the reason you said, that they would tell the grandparents, Daddy hit mommy, or Daddy said, I'm going to kill you someday, or something of that nature, you know? I mean, does it ever stop amazing us, Ann Bremner?
You know, it doesn't, Vito. It just never stops amazing us. And here, he's got an outlet with the media, and he can say all these horrible things that are false and defamatory, because, you know, she's gone, and he knows she's dead. And so he can say whatever he wants, that she was somebody that was a wanton woman that left her children and that we'll never see her again, but, you know, it's not his fault. And boy, the grandparents can't see the kids because, you know, he doesn't want to, like, have them impacted by these people that may say negative things, when in fact he's just trying to insulate himself from a murder prosecution, and he's doing a pretty good job.
But this go ahead.
And let me ask you this. I know he's throwing up these boyfriends. All right, he's saying that a lot. Has the police found any truth in that? And if they have they talked to any boyfriends, or is it just a smokescreen?
It's a smokescreen, and I guess the most ridiculous aspect of it is that there was a man that went missing in Utah, and so Josh Powell came out and said, that's who she ran off with. I mean, that's just crazy. I mean, to say, my wife has been missing all this time, but you know what, this guy that's missing? She was seeing him, and they ran off together. I mean, that just tells you how far-reaching, you know, he is in terms of just trying to stretch the truth and point, you know, the suspicion away from himself. But so far, you know, he's not arrested. He's still doing fine, and he feels like he can defame her with impunity. And I think about those kids and what's going to happen to them. Because in the long run, I think there will be a prosecution.
Do you know anything about a possible new girlfriend or any kind of job he has at all?
No.
Okay.
I mean, he likes to court the press and say all kinds of things about Susan when she was long suffering. I mean, she was living in a household where she had no independent life. She had no independent finances. She had no independent friends. And as he basically made her life only his and only about him, when she said, "I don't think I want to live this way," then something happened. And that's when
the
camping trip.
Across the country, this is a classic case of that evidence of abuse affidavit being put in place. I mean, I hear this in my
blood
boil.
You're right.
Susan. Every time.
Yeah, I mean,
every time.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Because, you know, here's a woman that didn't have any voice except for in her diary. But she's saying, you know, I need out of this. Even though I love my children and I want to maintain my marriage, I need to get out of this. And that's when she got killed.
And the kids are with a killer, in my opinion. I mean, the kids are with this person who's capable of hurting somebody else, their mother. And I don't think I'm not in agreement when any kind of case, when a Peterson happens or these other ones across the country, that they even have any access to their kids until it's determined. Because I think it's unsafe for the kids to be with the person who's a suspect.
Well, and here's, you know, the very sad fact about, you know, Chuck and Judy waiting and biding their time and being law-abiding, which is they've been told that when the case gets filed, if and when it gets filed, then the kids, of course, will be taken away from Josh. So it's better for them to wait for this case to be prosecuted than for them to take their own civil action in terms of trying to seek custody of the kids, because grandparents really have no rights. And until they can show that Josh committed the murder, they really don't have a lot of rights. So let the prosecution do it. But they've waited and waited and waited and waited.
What about the police department there? This is the first murder there in the history of that town.
I know.
And no one is saying that they're not ill-equipped to do this, but are things running, of course, a different way because it's possibly a small town that they've never had this before? I mean, this is intimate partner homicide and violence.
Right.
And there's not a lot of people around the country who are experts in this area. Is it possible? Are they bringing in other reinforcements, the FBI, other people that possibly could help enhance the continued investigation so there is an arrest quickly, soon?
Well, they've been very close-lipped about it. They've been very, you know, close to the vest in terms of their case. I always think of the JonBenet Ramsey case, you know, and that, of course, being a smaller jurisdiction and remaining unsolved, you know, indefinitely, you know, from here to eternity. But the fact is they say that they're close. You know, we have to believe in them because they're the only people we have to believe in. But, yeah, I mean, when they've only had one case, a homicide, and they're a smaller jurisdiction, you have to worry. This is not Seattle. This is not New York City. This is not Denver. And we don't know what they have from the forensics. We don't know what was in that stain on the floor. We don't know, you know, what they found in their diary. We don't know what they've done from talking to other people. But we do know.
But wasn't time wasted, though? The stain on the floor that wasn't tracked for a few days? So you have time to do something to that.
Well, yeah, and here's the killer, so to speak, in this case, is that Josh Powell, they searched his car, they got a search warrant, they go in the house, you know, et cetera, and then he's allowed to take a rental car and drive hundreds of miles, and they never searched that car, and we never knew where he went. And I think that's really, really important, because what in the heck was he doing after his wife went missing, driving around like that in a rental car?
And what about the kids? You know, the kids are now a little bit older. Their mom is not there. I mean, I just think that it wreaks havoc on them. And the fact that they're kind of out there in the compound, because it looked like from the interview from the Salt Lake, Utah paper, both father and son seem to have a lot to say about this entire case. And it in kind of a sick, twisted way.
It's sick and twisted, and you're exactly right. His father, Stephen, had made comments about how he wanted to, like, hold Susan captive in his house and about how he wanted to have a relationship with her, you know, during the course of the marriage with Josh. I mean, it's really creepy stuff. And, you know, talking about her as kind of an object and demeaning her as somebody that would be, you know, arguably from their standpoint promiscuous and you know, would abandon her children. And I think that's the worst thing, you know, is to sit and defame the missing, or the dad, presumably, with impunity, because no one stops them, and there's no prosecution right now that would indicate that they're involved. But to say, I mean, the father of the husband to say, I'd like to hold her here, you know, as you know, someone sexual for me, is just beyond creepy.
So across the country with this kind of case, somebody's listening right now, and they have a loved one, and it's the early stages of the case. What should they do to secure information and, you know, possibly seek a lawyer or a PI so they can receive the same manner that, that the Coxes have with you?
Well, I think, you know, I'd love to have Vito in every case. I think.
Oh, no. The Italian stallion? I don't know.
Yeah. But I think they need to start from the beginning with the assumption that, and I hate to say this, but you need to start with the assumption that the government is not going to do what they should do. And therefore, you know, you're going to file within the statute of limitations, and you're going to conduct your own investigation, especially if you're correct, like this case.
You know, Ian, as a listener to you, it's I hope they got other jurisdictions involved in this, okay? Because
right.
Being an ex-cop and working a lot of murder cases in my life as a private detective, you can't have your first murder in a town and have the police open up a murder cases 101 book and start
I
from
know.
Page one and try to solve it. I mean, if that is the case, that's a pride issue, because then you have them all say,
right.
"Hey, this is our one murder case in our career, and we ain't letting go of it," you know. And it's a shame, because what will happen, you know yourself, a good defense attorney will eat that case up when it goes to court.
Not if they have the evidence or abuse affidavit. And Denny, you know, if you look at this, the books that you write about a lot of the people that you in real life. They're protected by the government when they have information. Don't you think that maybe the kids in these cases should have that same kind of protection by the government until they figure out who's done it kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. It's mind-boggling that it's not that way.
We don't protect these kids. And I don't understand in all these cases.
No, there's a lot of injustices around, as we're finding out, and that's in that category, I believe. The statute of limitations on the wrongful death. I mean, there's a lot of things. It seems like most people would think, geez, the family, you know, the victim, or in the case of the family of a deceased victim, you know, the government, the system's going to do everything and go all out and so on and so forth to protect them, to make sure justice is served. And that certainly isn't the way it is in every case. There's a lot of things. You know, difficulties with investigations. There's the statute of limitations to take a tool virtually away from the families. I mean, you've got to act so quickly that by the time most people get over the grief and realize what's happened, that statute's probably shot. You probably missed the boat. And it's just really a shame that, you know, everything seems to go toward the protecting the suspects and so forth. I mean, they're entitled to their rights, but you got to have kind of a fair playing field. In a lot of cases, I don't think it's fair.
And you don't. And look at it, Ann, in this case, too, I had heard Chuck say on a number of interviews, he wasn't allowed to even go and get any of Susan's things, her belongings, her photos.
No, and you don't. Or her diary. And those are things we've also looked at under the victim's rights statutes. You know, can we go in and get those things? And then the government or the police say, well, we really don't want to give those to you, but the family wants to know. They want to know, what was she thinking at the time? What preceded this? I mean, obviously she wanted a divorce, and she ended up with a death sentence, you know? And, you know, who goes camping in sub-zero temperatures at midnight with two little kids and then comes home and says, oops, my wife's gone, you know? I don't know where she went. I think she ran off with some guy. Yeah, that's what this case is, and he didn't report it for days, and, you know, and yet we don't have a prosecution, and I think, you know, what Denny said, and Vito, and you, Susan, is that these cases demand justice, and I think I would like to see these statutes of limitations extended, just like we do in sex assault cases. Isn't murder more important? I mean, sexual assault is, of course, very important, but murder, more important.
Yeah.
Let's make sure that we give people justice.
We are out of time. Thank you, Ann Bremner, so much. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show is Tuesday, March 15th, 2011. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt, and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com, or to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Annie, can you call me?
Yeah.
Okay, I got a case. I have a case.
Okay, I'll call you right back.
Thanks.
I've got to look for your number. Okay, thanks.
All right, bye.
Good night, everybody.